Christians, like other religious people, have to manage the relationship between their belief in supernatural forces and an afterlife on one side, and how those beliefs impact their daily life on the other. This was especially difficult for Korean Protestant Christians and members of an indigenous religion influenced by Christianity, Chundogyo, during the Japanese colonial period of 1910 to 1945, when Christians faced a repressive government, growing criticism of religion, and the social and cultural dislocations caused by the continued onrush of modernity into the peninsula. In his thorough and well-researched book, Building a Heaven on Earth, Religion, Activism, and Protest in Japanese-Occupied Korea, published by the University of Hawaii Press, Albert Park examines how Korean Protestant Christians, as well as members of Chundogyo, dealt with these difficulties by developing theologies that found the source of renewal in Korean national identity in the countryside. Through a sensitive and careful interrogation of the thought and efforts of these activists, Park unearths a largely ignored aspect of Korean religious history, leading to a book that will be of interest to both scholars of Christianity as well as students of religious responses to modernity. I hope you'll enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. And we'll be talking to Dr. Albert Park about his new book, Building a Heaven on Earth, Religion, Activism, and Protest in Japanese-Occupied Korea, which has been published by University of Hawaii Press. And I have the honor, this is actually our second time talking to Dr. Park. He was the one who gave me my first interview on the channel, so it's great to have him back. Albert, welcome again to the show.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me, Frank. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Well, and before, usually we start off talking, and of course, it's always a pleasure talking to you too. And before we talk about, usually we talk about the bio first, I ask the interviewee about that person's life. But before we do that, I just wanted to note that Albert has dedicated this book to Andrew Park. So I wanted to give Albert just a moment to tell us about Andrew and this dedication.
Sure. No, thanks for this opportunity. So yeah, the book is dedicated to the memory of my nephew, Andrew Park, who unfortunately passed away from leukemia about a couple years ago, and he was only 16 years old. So I knew Andrew, because he was my nephew, and he was the oldest son of my older brother. And so he was the first grandson in our family. So I spent a lot of time with him, and I grew up with him and in Chicago and so forth. So I knew Andrew very well, loved him very deeply. And so a couple of years ago, he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, went under remission, and then he got leukemia, and he fought it heroically, but unfortunately passed away. And I dedicated the book to him because he really taught me a lot about everything. This young 16-year-old, when he was in immense pain because of the cancer, was tremendously heroic in the way he was fighting it, and as well as the way he really enjoyed life, despite the fact that he was gravely ill, and showed an immense amount of love to others while he was sick. And so while I was writing this book, it was, you know, he was gravely ill. And so I was always thinking about Andrew when it got really hard for me to write, and I was getting major writing block, or I was very stressed out. I always just thought about Andrew and just thought about how he fought through things and how he was a real role model for me and in how to really live life. So in the end, when I was finishing up everything, I just asked my editor if we can have just one page dedicated to him, you know, in his memory. And they, of course, said yes. And so this is one way I wanted to really thank Andrew. Of course, the book is dedicated to my wife, Jennifer, and of course my daughter, but I really wanted to acknowledge Andrew because he was a real force in my life while he was alive and continues to be a force today. I think about him every single day. So it's great that his name can be in this book forever.
That's a very inspiring story, and I'm sure that Andrew is very proud of this book, because it is a great book.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
So he'll be happy that there's an Andrew and an Albert both attached.
Yes, yeah.
This book, definitely double A.
Yes, yes.
So I wonder then if you could tell us a little, before we get back to the book, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm an associate professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. We're part of the CMC, or Claremont McKenna College, is part of the Claremont College Consortium, in which we're made up of, which is made up of Claremont McKenna, Pomona College, Pitzer College, Harvey Mudd College, and Scripps College. And then there's a university here, Claremont Graduate University, and we're about 30 miles east of Los Angeles. And I've been here for about 8 years. And my research interest lies, of course, in modern Korean history, particularly looking at the relationship between political economy and culture, political economy and religion, as this book talks about a lot. And so not only do I look at those themes through the context of modern Korean history, but East Asian history as well. So I really enjoy studying things through a multidisciplinary lens. And hopefully this book shows some of my interest in that multidisciplinary approach to studying history.
Well, I think it does, and it really turns out to be a really fascinating book in a lot of ways. So I guess that that being said, shall we just jump in?
Sure, yeah, of course.
So, of course, again, the book is Building a Heaven on Earth, and it's real. Can you tell us about this crisis brought on by the coming in of modernization into Korea? So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that crisis.
Yeah, when you have modernization happening in Korea after colonization, specifically after 1910, you start to see what I would say major ruptures in society. And particularly those ruptures are caused by economic forces, as well as cultural, social forces, but particularly economic forces in the countryside. And those economic forces are capitalism. And as many of your people know already, Japanese colonialism integrated Korea's agricultural economy to Japan, as well as East Asia, as well as the world. And these brought in a lot of new forces, particularly capital, new institutions, banks, etc. And these were greatly affecting most parts of society. In particularly, it was creating some transformed relationships in the countryside, where landlords are treating their peasants differently based on the capitalist logic, where before it was based on Confucianism and other traditional forms of knowledge. And so you have transformation of social relationships, you have money coming in quickly into the countryside, and then being pulled out by investors and by banks, which wreaks havoc in the lives of peasants. And essentially in this transition, you have peasants transitioning trying to negotiate a new capitalist system. And as we know, peasants don't have that many resources. And so it was an extreme challenge for peasants to negotiate securely this new capitalist environment. So you had these great changes in the countryside that that were also eroding a lot of traditional ways of living and so forth. So basically what I would say is modernization is causing all these great ruptures and changes that in the end some people found very exhilarating and really enjoy, but on the other hand, some people found very frightening and were a bit concerned about these changes. So there was a lot of mixed feelings towards modernization at that time.
Just for our listeners to be clear, Dr. Park's book is focusing on the Japanese colonial period in Korea, when Korea had been annexed by Japan in 1910 and was ruled by Japan until 1945. And because of that colonial relationship, you know, these forces of modernity that are impacting Korea, it's really what we would call a form of colonial modernity, which is a kind of term you use in this book. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what that means?
Sure. So when we think about modernity or modernization and so forth, in the colonial Korea context, we often use the word colonial modernity. And basically, it's the idea that modernity is negotiated and filtered through colonialism, as opposed to modernity happening in, let's say, the United States or in Europe at the same time, which, of course, were not colonized. They themselves were colonizers. But in the Korean context, the experience of the modern, anything related to the modern, is filtered through colonialism. So you have what that means, you have a power system, a colonial system that basically shapes the way that modernization programs will play out in on the peninsula. But also you have ideas about modernity and modernization coming into Korea via Japan, because many Koreans, of course, were going to Japan to study, Korean intellectuals and young students going to Japan and learning all about these, what they would say, modern ideas and so forth. So that in one sense, that's what colonial modernity means, modernity negotiated through, filtered through colonialism. On the other hand, it also is a paradigm in the sense the way you study colonialism. So, as you know, studying the colonial period is very controversial, and it's filled with a lot of issues because a lot of things happened during that period, and it's things that are very sensitive to people today and back then, of course. And traditionally, the way colonialism has been studied is, well, you know, Japan, one party would say, well, Japan actually modernized Korea and made it better. And then there's the other group that says, well, no, they exploited Korean resources and they took things from Korea and they robbed us of our identity and so forth, of our independence. And so what they did was not good, which they would say was actually bad. It was very negative. And so what you have is the exploitation camp and then the modernization camp. And about 15, 20 years ago, there was a book called Colonial Modernity in Korea, published by Gyuk Shin and Michael Robinson, which had a bunch of articles in there talking about a new way of studying colonialism in 1920s, 1930s, or during the colonial period in Korea, and particularly trying to move away from exploitation arguments or modernization arguments and trying to see how everyday life was shaped by the various forces that were playing out, capitalism, socialism, various cultural issues, popular culture, music, how those forces were really shaping everyday life and influencing identities and behavior and so forth, and looking at things very carefully and not necessarily jumping to the conclusion saying, no, it's all about exploitation or this was all about modernization. It was good or bad. Trying to have a nuanced way of looking at the colonial experience. And so, you know, what my book tries to do is in part to kind of piggyback on the colonial modernity paradigm and say, look, we have to look at religion in the colonial period in a very nuanced way. Not everything was about, of course, nationalism and so forth. You know? And so in the end, we have to look at how, you know, these religious figures were negotiating capitalism and so forth, and looking in a very nuanced way, looking at the diversity of thoughts and so forth. So in many ways, the book is really talking about colonial modernity, but I also have, well, you know, some criticisms about the colonial modernity paradigm, particularly the way that I think some scholars have defined modernity, and as well as their objects of study, what they particularly study. In particular, most studies of colonial modernity look at urban issues. They don't really look at rural issues. And in fact, I think in general, there hasn't been that many books recently on rural affairs in Korea, despite the fact that 90% of the population lived and worked in the rural areas and in agriculture. There has been a tremendous amount of focus on urban issues, particularly if we were talking about urban issues, particularly just one city, Seoul. You don't find that many studies looking necessarily at Pyongyang, which is, of course, was another large city at that time. So my book really is in line with the colonial modernity paradigm, but also in some ways is criticizing it.
Right. Yeah. I think it's really adding a lot to the scholarship by saying, hey, let's get out of the cities or the city, Seoul, and let's get into the countryside. And let's also consider what religious people are doing, which is interesting because a lot of times there's this tendency to say, well, religion, that's not modern. So how does this, this crisis, you talk a lot about this, how religion faces this crisis in your introduction.
Right. How does religion kind of play out in this book?
Yes. Yeah.
So essentially what happens in the 1920s is in the midst of all these ruptures and transformation caused by capitalism, you have various things happening in relation to those changes. Particularly, you have people seeking new forms of representation, seeking new ways of looking at the world. Because if you think about it, in the 1920s and 1930s, with all these changes, if capitalism and these outside cultural ideas and social and ideas are coming from the outside and into Korea, influencing people, motivating people to rejecting traditions and so forth. I mean, in a sense, because you have these new ideas, practices, institutions causing all these changes, in changes that are really affecting people's everyday lives, a lot of people in the 20s and 30s, so let's say 1920 to 1937, which my book covers, people are seeking new ways of understanding the world, looking at the world through a new lens, and relying on other forms of knowledge, systems of knowledge, not necessarily Confucianism or Buddhism and so forth. Essentially not trying to rely on traditional systems of knowledge that were just inadequate. It just couldn't represent and give meaning to the world anymore. So that's why at this time you see many people turning to various other ideologies, particularly leftist ideologies, Marxism, socialism, and so forth. You see many of the bourgeois nationalists looking at concepts of democracy and of the idea of what is industrial capitalism, and looking at essentially outside of Korea for ideologies that will help them to understand what's happening within Korea. And what ends up happening is, as people are looking for these ideologies, turning to these ideologies, there is starting to become more and more criticism against religion by the mid-1920s, particularly arguing when, you know, religion the way that religion is presented in Korea and practiced in Korea, it just can't make sense of anything. It can't make sense of why people are suffering under capitalism. It can't provide any meaningful direction and so forth. So arguments from the left and right were saying, you know, religion is really a form of drug that is telling people, is convincing people that they shouldn't really care about the world and just care about the afterlife or spiritual concerns and not really pay attention to what's going around in their life and trying to reconstruct society and make things better for people. So there was a tremendous amount of criticism against religion for that. Essentially, if you want to say like otherworldliness or spiritual issues. And by the 1920s, mid-1925, there were these massive anti-religion campaigns, basically saying, you know, religion is out of date. And on top of that, the religion, because it's out of date, it only cares about spiritual issues, otherworldly issues, that it has no place in a modern society, which, of course, is an argument made against religion, not only in Korea, but in other parts of the world at that time. Since the advent of modernity in Europe too, where people say you can't be religious and modern at the same time, because religion is all about spiritual issues and modernity is supposedly just about rationality and reflexivity, and which religion is not about. And so there's all these criticisms in Korea at that time against religion. And so then you have a bunch of figures responding to what's going on materially, all these changes that are happening in Korea due to capitalism, but also due to responding to the anti-religion campaigns.
Right. So this is a serious issue for the groups in Korea. So if it's okay now, maybe we should move to chapter one, so you can tell us about the three main religious groups you're going to be looking at.
Right. So chapter one looks at the rise of new religions, that I would say, and particularly looking at certain Protestant Christian groups and the Tongak, which is the precursor to the Chandogyo. So Tongak, Eastern learning, and Chandogyo, it later becomes Chandogyo, religion of the heavenly way. So I'm looking at Tongak, and I'm looking also at various types of Protestant Christian groups, although ultimately I'll focus on the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA, and an arm of the Presbyterian Church that becomes very active in the rural movements. But in the first chapter, though, I look at all these Protestant Christian groups and the Tongak, and basically show how they were established and so forth, and talk about their significance and their value, because they really did have value to people at that time when Korea, even though I really emphasize in the 1920s and 1930s that Korea was changing dramatically. I mean, Korea was also changing and transforming in the late 19th century, especially after 1875, 1876, when Japan forcibly opens up Korea in the late 19th century due to domestic problems. The monarchy, of course, cannot alleviate poverty and various other social and economic issues. The social system is in flux, where social hierarchy is no longer the government says there's a social hierarchy system still, but nevertheless, there's tremendous flux within social hierarchy system. People are going up and down the social hierarchy system. And so you have a great number of changes happening in late 19th century Korea. And I would, argue when Protestant Christianity comes after 1885, their ideas about how to looking at the world, conceptions of the individual, conceptions of society, are I think of some value to people. It helps them to understand, okay, this is how the world works, this is how it operates. In some ways, it's like any ideology. It's informing their worldview and giving them meaning to their existence, as well as direction about their existence. And so I talk about that, about what Protestant Christians, that particularly the language that they're providing, that gives this meaning and direction to them. And then I talk about, of course, Tongak, how Tongak not only provides this new meaningful language to many Koreans in the countryside, but also helps organize them. So Tongak provides this organizational structure in which groups and figures in the Tonga group can come together and start actually plotting a protest against the government, which ultimately leads to the Tonga, some call it rebellion, some call it revolution, but this large-scale movement against this government against the Korean government by 1895. And I would argue then there people are attracted to this religion because it's again giving a new understanding about the individual, that saying that the individual has true value, true worth, and it's not necessarily tied to, is not identified or defined by social hierarchy system. So individuals were, I think, at the time really appreciate Tonggak because it really gives them new worth or value of their life, new significance. And so it helps organize them. But, you know, I also argue that for the Tonggak movement that happens in 1895, and this is what, I think I catch a little flack with, particularly with some of the Tonggak specialists and some other scholars. I remember reading some of my reviews to my books that saying it, when I argue, it wasn't necessarily a religious inspired movement. And what I mean by that is the Tonggak leaders did not have this system of knowledge or this system of religious ideas that were calling for them to create a new world for their followers, creating this, the word I use is Chisang Chongguk, which is heaven on earth. It wasn't a movement that, called for this creation of heaven and earth. The Tonggak leaders were not really calling for this, for this new heaven and earth that's trying to create this kind of utopian society. I would argue that the Tonggak, first of all, many people know the Tonggak movement wasn't organized by the Tonggak leaders themselves. It was the main leaders in the organization, but these other figures. And it's eventually that the main Tonggak leaders jump on to this movement. So in general, I don't call it a religious social movement. In name they just use Tonggak. For religion, I also argue that despite the fact that it provides all this new meaning and values at the time, which are significant for many people in Korea, it is a very otherworldly type of religious viewpoint being kind of spread amongst people. And then one person I look at is like Kim Sun-ju and some other Presbyterian leaders who argued that, Koreans should wait for Christ's return to earth and should kind of endure to that point. So they shouldn't really do anything. So I'm basically setting up the picture and showing that in the late 19th century religion, you don't have this drives to recreate the world, to transform the world, to create these utopian societies where there's economic, social, political equality. That figures that I studied in the 1920s and 1930s, they call for. You don't have that in the late 19th century. You really do have these movements that are not calling for the social transformation of social structures and so forth. But, I argue at the end of the chapter, but that's fine. At that moment, that historical moment, that they still served a function. They had a role. And one can imagine at that time, too, by 1905, 1910, or 1915, you couldn't have a large-scale mass movement. The colonial government would not allow it. So I argue, like, Kim Sun-ju's views about Christ returning are, in fact, one way of resistance against the colonial government. It's not an outright resistance in which they call out for new movements against the colonial government, but it's kind of an internal protest where they're saying, we just have to wait. We don't necessarily, we reject colonialism, but we're not going to necessarily do anything about it right now. We're going to wait because we think we know we're going to be delivered from this oppression. That's what the first chapter does. It kind of looks at the origins of these groups, looks at what they're doing, the institutions they set up, and the philosophies and ideas.
Right. So, excellent. And for our listeners, just so you know, this is really an important chapter because you may not be a Koreanist. Many of our listeners, of course, are interested in religion, but chapter one will help you to understand this book. So don't be intimidated by the deep connections this has to Korean history. Once you read chapter one, you'll be fine.
Yes.
So it's interesting then because we have kind of we need a bridge here because you talked about in the introduction how you have these religious people, the Christians and members of Chundogyo, yeah, who are trying to build this heaven on earth, who are engaged in rural revitalization.
Right.
For one, giving the background, you were talking about how they weren't engaged in these things.
Right.
So what happens? Why do these people who weren't interested in rural revitalization and dealing with modernity, why are they suddenly interested in it?
Yeah, so that's the most important question to my book because, as I explained just a second ago, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, let's just say up to like 1919, before the March 1st movement. March 1st movement, 1919 movement is the largest protests at the time against Japanese colonialism. But before then, you don't really have these major calls by religious leaders to recreate society, transform society. And essentially what I would say, there's a lack of these social religions where they're very concerned about the social, about the world, about transformation, and then addressing all the economic, social, political inequality through creating a new world, a new heaven on earth. So I would argue in the 1920s, it's a changed atmosphere. As I talk about in chapter two, you have the rise of not the rise of capitalism, but capitalism is certainly becoming more of a prominent force in colonial Korea, especially in the agricultural sector. There's a growing commercialization of agriculture because Japan ultimately relies on Korea for its agricultural resources. And so, as I mentioned in this interview earlier on about what was happening in the countryside in the 1920s, so due to these capitalist forces, really many introduced by the colonial government through their own programs such as programs to enhance rice production, in which they work with landlords to force peasants and they would say encourage peasants to work harder and producing more rice and so forth. So you have all these mechanisms that are influencing capitalist practices and capitalist logic and causing all these transformations. And as I mentioned, it's also weakening many of the positions of peasants who are, to be honest, subsistence farmers, majority of them, not all of them, but majority of them are. And so they don't have the resources to deal with the change environment. So so you have that. So chapter two talks about that. That's the whole chapter where it's just explaining these economic transformations. And then you have the rise of Marxism, leftist ideologies, all these other ideologies, then talking about the problem with religion. And so what I would argue, and this is coming to chapter three, is with the 1925 anti-religion protests, which, as I explained, is not only happening in Korea, but it's happening also in East Asia, but also through the world. As I didn't know, there was not necessarily anti-religion movements in the United States, but there was a lot of criticism against religion and the declining membership in many churches at the time. So in Korea itself, these anti-religion movements, combining with these transformations in the economy, were leading many religious leaders, particularly in the Presbyterian Church, the YMCA, and Chundogyo just to start thinking, what does this all mean? What does this all mean for religion? What does it mean for Korea? But particularly, you know, what does this mean for a modern Korea? So what I found really fascinating about these figures in these three respective groups is they're saying, well, look, Korea is now in the modern period. And they would say the modern period, this new historical period that that created this new temporality, a temporality that features constant changes. And they're thinking, well, we're in this new temporality, this new historical moment called the modern. And, you know, how do we adapt to that? How do we adapt our religious principles and our practices to this new environment, especially when people in the countryside, in the city, are asking for new forms of representation? How do you make sense of this world? Because clearly people think at this time that religion just can't make sense of anything. It can't make sense of capitalism. It can't make sense of all these erosion of traditions. So they're thinking we have to create, which I would say, these new modern systems of religion or modern forms of religion. And so what ends up happening, interesting, these are three different groups, but they think very similarly in how to adapt religion to the present environment. And particularly, I would say they create which is a term I coined as a religion of the present, where they speak of religion as this valuable source of knowledge, source of information, source of practice. In particular, it's valuable because it provides people with absolute value, absolute identity, absolute love that's unchanging. So when it comes down to it, they were emphasizing, let's just take, for example, the YMCA. There was two figures, Shin Eung-woo and Hong Byun-sun. Hong Byun-sun is an absolutely fantastic, you know, interesting figure, and who wrote about this, the relationship between religion and modernity. And they were arguing, well, look, you know, Christianity is not about conversion. It's not about the word. It's not about studying doctrine. It really, in the end, is about action. It really isn't about, at the end of the day, it's about everyday life. It's about experiences in the everyday life. And they would say that all the experiences in everyday life, eating with other people, working together, having fun with other people, you know, forms of recreation together. So basically having forms of community are ways in which you experience God and ultimately love. And they would argue in the present every day, as you're enjoying these experiences, you experience absolute love, absolute identity. These elements that will give you meaning and purpose and value in the midst of changes. Because at the end of the day, many people were asking, you know, what does this all mean in the midst of change? If things are just changing rapidly, what is really authentic? You know, what is not authentic? And these religious figures are saying, look, you know, religion is about, it will help you to give you meaning in the midst of all these changes. And more importantly, security. Security in the sense that you will have this absolute value that won't disappear due to material transformations. And so, you know, they're really emphasizing in this religion and talking about the value of it. It really helps people live a fruitful modern life. It will motivate people to really engage life, to engage everyday life, to really be out there because they have the security that religion provides. So that's one way they connect religion and modernity, saying, like, in the midst of this modern period, religion definitely has a function and a role. Now, they understand, though, that in everyday life, it's fraught with many challenges and many problems, particularly social, economic inequality. And so the question is, they recognize that there's this disconnection from God. And so what you need to do then is to help create a secure material environment in which people can experience God in everyday. So this then leads to a new social religion or social religious belief, saying that we need to then go out and create a new world. We have to create a heaven on earth where there is absolute, there is this security, material security, and this stability in which people can experience God and therefore connect them to these eternal spiritual forces. And so you have that in the YMCA, but in the Presbyterian under Pei Men Su, you have very similar ideas. And even in Chundogyo, they don't use the word God necessarily, and they don't use necessarily the same exact language as the Christians, but the concepts are the same, where they are saying, you know, there is these religious forces out there that give you absolute value and this identity that will continue on in the midst of changes, and that this is why religion is very valuable for modern life. But again, just like the YMCA and Presbyterian figures were saying, you need to create an ideal environment in which people can experience this. You need to create an ideal environment where people can experience this material security. So that's when they go out, and the Chundogyo are actually arguing that you have to create a Jisang Chungguk. So this Jisang Chungguk language is never in the late 19th century, from what I found. I mean, you might have found something different, and maybe other religious scholars, but I've never found this Jisang Chungguk language late 19th century, early 20th century. It's only in the 1920s that I really see the prominence of this term, Jisang Chungguk, creating a new world, creating a new utopian world. And I think that's in response to all those changes happening because of modernization in the
1920s. Right, well, definitely looking at the Catholics, I mean, the world is one of your enemies, right?
Yeah.
So there's no idea of building a heaven on earth. And for our listeners, of course, I specialize in the Korean Catholics. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the interesting thing, right? I mean, it's not only just the Catholics, but it's religion has this, I mean, Korean religions in Korea have this kind of feelings about the material world and kind of denigrate it in some ways and feel like it's not a place of spirituality. Especially everyday life. I mean, if we think about the Presbyterian, Methodists, I mean, all Korean Christians were emphasizing, well, you experience God through conversion. You know, you have to accept Christ as your Savior, and it's through the Word that you experience God, reading the Bible and so forth. There wasn't this emphasis on the world and what the world, the various things that happen in the world, in people's actual everyday lives, the nitty-gritty, the dirty things in their everyday life, the good things, I mean, the various things in their everyday life. There was this kind of belief that this was, many people thought, a place of evil where, you know, was the evil sacred forces or evil spiritual forces prevent you from experiencing or having an authentic religious experience. And so there was this kind of devaluation of everyday life, whereas I would argue, like Hong Byun-sun, Lee Tong-hwa of the Chundogyo, you know, Pei Men-su, Yu Chae-gi, Lee Hoon-gu, all these figures were saying, no, we have to rethink about the value. We have to kind of reevaluate everyday life and its position in religion, and say, in fact, that it has significant value. That those are the grounds for religious experience. It's not through conversion, and we, if we want people to experience God or Hanonim in Chundogyo, or if you want to experience these religious forces, then you have to create a new world. You have to be out there. You have to fight inequality and bring about better conditions. So it's very similar to, you know, 1920s social gospel philosophy or theology that was spreading around the United States and Europe.
Right, right. And so in chapter 3, you've really set the doctrinal foundation for these groups. And then in chapter 4, you move to their actual rural reconstruction campaigns.
Yeah. So, you know, first three chapters is really about the intellectual framework, setting up how are these new ideas created? And, you know, as an intellectual historian, you're always interested how ideas form in relation to structures. At least that's the way I was taught to think of like an intellectual historian. So the three chapters is always about ideas in relation to social structures and in relation to society. And so by the end of chapter three, there's these new kind of ideas about creating a new heaven on earth and really trying to create the ideal everyday life through which people can experience these sacred forces or spiritual forces and live an authentic life, stable material life, and so forth. So chapter four to chapter six is about the actual movements themselves. So the YMCA in 1925 create a rural reconstruction movement to go out in the countryside to create their Chisang Chonggu, the heaven on earth. The Presbyterians formed their own organization in the late 1920s to create a Chisang Chonggu in the rural side. And so did the Chandogyo through their organization, the Chosung Nongmin Sa, which is the arm of the Chandogyo youth group. So interestingly, so you have these three very different religious groups who are very similar in terms of the way they think about approaching everyday life and the value of religion and connecting religion and modernity. And then you have them all, you know, thinking about, well, if we're going to create this ideal heaven on earth, where is it going to be? And they immediately say, well, it's not going to be in the cities. It's going to be in the countryside. And there's specific reasons for that. And this is where then questions of modernity and modernization come to play into this book, where, you know, they really were arguing or really disapproved and rejected normative views of modernity. And what I mean by that, and I'm going to take a couple minutes to explain this because it's really important to explain what I mean by modern and modernization and modernity. Essentially, when you think about the term modern in the 1920s, most Koreans thought of modern as the stage of history, as the ultimate stage of history in which you enjoy endless progress. So the stage of history was good. So words like good and it's full of progress, those words were attached to the modern. And this was not a belief unique to Koreans. This was a belief held throughout the world at that time by Europeans, people on the continent of Africa, in Japan, China, the United States, where there's this belief that everyone needs to achieve the modern stage of history. And as Timothy Mitchell and various other scholars have taught, explained, you know, this idea that the modern as the ultimate stage of history that everyone needs to achieve was basically formed, this idea, through an ideological process started in the West, where it is this belief that Westerners and non-Westerners should all achieve it, this ultimate stage of history, that they should all be connected to one linear form of history, that everyone should be connected to this one linear form of history. It should all strive towards this one linear form of history. And as Timothy Mitchell and other people point out, what ends up happening is, well, the question is, how do you achieve this modern stage of history? So then you'll have to have norms. And so what ends up happening, as Mitchell points out and others, is that because Europeans and people in the West achieved this modern stage of history, well, then you have to kind of mimic what they did. You have to apply those norms in those countries to your own country. So, for example, you have to have industrial capitalism. You have to have urbanization. Some would say you have to have secularization and so forth. And what ends up happening is that they become these, not only these very particular characteristics of each country become universal norms that undergird the this idea of modernity. And so what happens is Koreans from the left and right believe that you need to apply these norms. You have to have urbanization. You have to have industrial capitalism and so forth in order to achieve this modern stage of history. And I do have to point out, too, here, as Raymond Williams points out very well, you know, modern did not mean the modern, the ultimate stage of history. Initially, as he points out, I think it's either in Keywords or I think Politics of Modernism, points out, you know, originally modern was first used as a chronological category. It just meant after tradition, or it just meant after the feudal period, or it didn't have this normative connotation to it. And so I really point that out to really show that this idea of modern starts as a chronological category, but then becomes ideologized to the point that it becomes this ultimate stage of history that everyone has to achieve. Well, long story short, in Korea, figures believe they need to achieve this. And so there's this real push for urbanization or industrial capitalism. And there's a real disregard for the rule. And there's a disregard for the rule because I think on both sides, especially within the leftists, but also within the bourgeois nationalists, there's the idea that, you know, in the agriculture and rural, the mode of production and the environment is archaic. It's feudal. Those systems, let's say mode of production and the working environment, the rural environment, create an overall environment that prohibits the creation of the necessary consciousness, a consciousness necessary for revolution. And so everyone was trying to organize the peasants, but they didn't necessarily believe that peasants should be the vanguards of a revolution, or should be the main figures in a nation state. Well, the people that I study, the Chondogyo YMCA and Presbyterian, disagreed. And they said, no, we really believe that, they are rural society, agriculture, especially the peasants, should be at the center of this new heaven on earth. And they said it for various reasons, particularly because they believe that, the agriculture leads to self-subsistence, independence. The Chondogyo argued that agriculture is the source of wealth, which is no different what the physiocrats were arguing. So it provides independence not only for the individual, but also for the country. And they also argue that countryside is this great place of therapy where you can enjoy nature and then encounter religious experiences very easily because of the environment. And then they would also argue, well, you know, peasants have always been part of our culture, our identity. It's constituted our identity, agriculture, peasantry. Essentially, they were really valuing, saying, you know, look at Korea at this moment. We are agriculture. Why fundamentally transform it? And I'm sorry if I'm going on and on, but one thing I could just lastly say is, you know, they said that, you know, rural agriculture, we should turn to it as a source for helping us think about creating a modern society for the various reasons that I told you. But they also said that there's no contradiction of having a rural society and being modern, which at the time in many Western countries, people were saying you can't be modern and rural. And I would argue, and this is a real crucial argument made in Chapter 3 and Chapter 4, is based on how they view modernity, the religious figures. They argue that modernity is not about achieving a stage of history, the ultimate stage of history. What they would emphasize is that modernity, or being modern, is a mode of living, mode of existence that is rooted in the present. And what I mean by that is being modern is living in the moment and then taking whatever is in that moment. So in the moment, in the present, you have the past in the present, because the past always shapes the present and is always embodied in the present structures. And so you have the past and present, and in that moment, these religious figures would say is that you should try to create something new out of it. You can create something new. You just don't denigrate the past, but you try to take whatever is there at that moment in the present and do something with it and try to create something new and so forth. So essentially what I argue is, you know, it made sense for them to value the rule in this new modern vision of Korea for practical reasons, but also for based on their philosophy of the modern that, you know, that modernity means basically that you have a life rooted in the present, that it's you know, their attitude and mode of living were just rooted in the present. In the present. So anyways, let me stop there. I've been talking too much. So.
No, that's really good. And I think you did a wonderful job summarizing this really important couple of chapters in your book. And this is, I think, what one of the major contributions is to say, well, look, it's not just in the city that things are going on. And there's a religious voices there, too. And one thing I think is really fascinating as well is that looking not simply they're able to find an alternative modernity in of all places in Denmark.
Yes.
And that's the subject of your next chapter.
Yeah. So, moving to chapter five. So Denmark. Yeah. I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I've been talking about Denmark for the last 8-10 years of my life. And it's not necessarily because, you know, I have a deep fascination with Denmark, although I really do really enjoy the history of that culture and of the Danes, and I've always appreciated Danish design and architecture and so forth. But it really was my fascination with Denmark had a lot to do with what the people themselves were saying in the 1920s and 1930s, especially these rural leaders in the YMCA, Presbyterian, Chandogyo, but equally important, if you look at the Dongha Ilbo, Joseon Ilbo, the two main newspapers at the time, you can read about how people were really valuing and really speaking highly of Denmark, which really struck me because when we think about countries today that were these ideal countries that people aspired to become, like, you don't think of Denmark at all. And but, you know, in the 20s and 30s, Koreans were really thinking about Denmark, and they're talking about Danish exercise, Danish cooperatives, Danish this, Danish that. So it's permeated. You could totally see it in all of the discourse on social development and innovation and so forth in colonial Korea. So the question is why Denmark? And essentially, Denmark, from what I knew about learned to study about the history, was able to become one of the largest agricultural superpowers in the world at the time through these innovative reforms, particularly through cooperatives, their Danish cooperative system, their educational system, which consider folk schools and other types of schools, and literacy programs and so forth. And we're able to kind of use all these mechanisms to revitalize the Danish agricultural system and rural life, which had been decimated by various events in Danish history, the Napoleonic Wars, annexation of key lands from Denmark by Prussia and Germany and so forth, and immense rural poverty. And there was this one religious leader, Grundtvig, who led the revitalization of the countryside. Because Koreans saw that Denmark was this very poor agricultural-based society, they thought, well, if we appropriate their reforms, then perhaps we can become a modern powerful agricultural society. So, you know, they recognized that the world was heavily industrializing, and, you know, everyone thought that the only way to become modern was, of course, through industry, industrial capitalism or industry. And so they recognized, well, you know, in order to become have a stable economy in this global economy that's industrializing, well, you need systems. And so you need systems that have worked. And so that's what they saw in Denmark. Now, this is in line with what they were talking about at the time about their in line of their philosophy about which I call reclamation. This idea that you really value place in their idea of modernity. Modernity is rooted in the present. In other words, you value place, you value what exists. And then they argue that then you take contemporary forms that are or ideas that are inside or outside of Korea and merge them or forge them or link them with place, what exists, to try to create something new. And this is a concept that I call reclamation, which is basically this idea of creating new value out of place. Reclamation is a term that I take from Alan Berger, who's actually a landscape architect at MIT, and his whole idea about reclaiming land and giving new value to it, and so forth. So, so that's a really interesting story about Denmark. I was actually very surprised by it.
It was really fascinating to me. I didn't realize how important Denmark was in terms of world history until I read this chapter. So taking then what these people are learning from Denmark, how are they going to use that to transform peasants, as you talk about in chapter 6?
Yeah, so, I mean, chapter 5 and 6, 5 is on the Danish cooperative system and chapter 6 is on the educational system. Chapter 5 with the Danish cooperative system. So as many of your people know, co-ops, they're very attractive to people because they organize and pool the labor and resources of individuals to make a very powerful group. And the YMCA Chundogyo and Presbyterian started creating these co-ops throughout the countryside, literally going to the villages and creating them or teaching peasants how to make co-ops. And so one example is the YMCA going, and they particularly worked in the northern part of Korea, in Hamhung, Korea, and organized a bunch of apple farmers, peasants who had apple orchards, and pooled the labor and resources of these 30, 40 peasants, and then helped them to set up a relationship with a buyer in Japan, and would then help them box these apples and then transport and ship them to markets in Japan. So economically, this was a way to provide some type of stability. But the key attractive issue about this, and this is according to Hong Byun-sun, the architect of the YMCA rural movement, says cooperatives were valuable because it wasn't just about money. It was about saving and cultivating the individual. Because you're coming together, not necessarily just for economic stability, but you're coming to create a community where you're helping one another. And so labor under the cooperative movement is a very, which Hong Byun-sun would argue, is very different than other labor and other forms of systems. And particularly, they were just basically saying that labor helps unite individuals. It brings people together to care for one another, and then therefore creating what I would argue a moral economy. And so they had these various types of cooperative systems set up throughout Korea. Then they had educational systems, literacy programs, where they traveled to villages teaching people how to read and write. Introducing contemporary forms of agricultural practices and farming technology. they set up folk schools, which were these schools for young kids, and teaching them to become farmers. And it was an intensive program, and they were really concerned about the youth leaving the countryside. So they really targeted youth, because the youth, in their eyes, did not want to stay in the countryside. They wanted to go to the cities. So they ultimately were targeting youth and educating them. And I would say that's really problematic what they did. They were disciplining them in ways and basically saying that there is no, that they should have no diversity in thought, that they should only just become farmers. So it was a quite repressive disciplinary apparatus against the youth. And in fact, some peasants too. So that's a real problem with, I would argue, within this rural movement, the way that they sometimes tried to realize their ideals, because they really believed in a form, I would say, an agrarian modernism. So, yeah, so through schools, through cooperative systems, literacy programs, publications, they have many publications that had information and stories about peasants, and really kind of valorizing and saying that peasants really are valuable and the future of the nation.
Excellent. So I wonder if you could then tell us, I mean, this book was so fascinating to me because a lot of the stuff I just didn't know about. And what I find particularly fascinating is your conclusion, is you talk about how it continues to have a very important legacy in Korea today.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real struggle to write the conclusion. I mean, I did think about, after I did a lot of the research, think about, well, then what are, I really wanted to talk about, well, what is the impact after 1945, so 37, most of the movements end. So what happens after 1945? Do these ideas simply disappear? And it's a real particular question for any intellectual historian, because, you know, how do you, it's a challenging question, because, you know, how do you quantify the impact of an idea? And how do you show that an idea still exists? And so forth. And what I did, and you know, I think in my conclusion, I think I did add it in an adequate way, is to show, well, these ideas still continued on, specifically through the organizers themselves. So like Hong Byeon-sun, after 1945, continues to write about Denmark cooperatives and his religion of the present, and disseminates it through journals, publication, books, and so forth, all the way up into the 1950s. So even after the Korean War, and that's not only him, but like Pei Min-su and other figures, all of them continue to publish. So they are constantly trying to shape the discourse on social development at the time, and the concepts of modernity, trying to always provide alternative conceptions of modernity. In North Korea, and this is something that I just talked with scholars about, but I leave the information there so that scholars of North Korea can kind of pick up and maybe investigate more after 1945. So most of the Chundogyo farms, so they had not only co-ops, Chundogyo, but the cooperative farms where they got peasants to basically own a farm communally and work on it communally. And so a lot of these were located in Pyongyang and North Korea, and what is today North Korea. And the question is then, how did they get absorbed into the system in North Korea? Because the Chundogyo is an official part of the North Korean government, is considered one arm of the, or one party within the North Korean government. So, you know, I just leave it out there for other scholars to think about what is kind of the link between the colonial and the post-colonial through the Chundogyo farms and cooperatives. Particularly, I think there is a link in light of the Chundogyo had very, I would say, progressive views about the economy, very much teetering on the line of leftist thought and so forth. They're very sympathetic to leftist ideology and so forth. And Itoan Wang was constantly quoting Marx and really valued Marx and so forth. So I could see that there was probably conflict, but there was a lot more kind of cooperation than we may actually think. More so than conflict. In South Korea, I would argue that these ideas about alternative modernity, not necessarily the religious part, this idea about alternative modernity through agriculture has been embodied through contemporary cooperative movements like Hansalim, Dude, iCoop Korea, and so forth. They're not necessarily calling for the rejection of the rural, a rejection of the urban, but they do work in the countryside to enhance farming and to create new partnerships with the urban to create these alternative systems, particularly alternative systems to neoliberalism, which I have found completely fascinating. And I've interviewed many of them, worked with them, and they are trying to create these new systems to try to think about we have industrial capitalism, but is there any other alternative? So I think that kind of idea and philosophy really started in the 1920s, this idea of an agrarian modernism really has influenced co-ops certainly today. So intellectually, I think these ideas have informed practices, social structures, and institutions, and so forth. I was actually at Harvard over the weekend and giving a talk, and I remember many of the people in the audience were saying, well, you know, this sounds very much like the Semal Undong in the 1970s, which the government instituted, right, the rural reform programs. And, you know, in many ways, it was very similar ideas, although I think the outcomes and objectives are very different. And the Semal Undong was a very top-down movement, where this is the movements I'm talking about really bottom-up. So, but no, there's still this kind of, links to the colonial period, these intellectual links that certainly exist, I truly believe in.
Oh, excellent. Well, this was really a wonderful book, and I think Albert did a great job summarizing it, but it's just impossible to do it justice in an hour. So please go on to our listeners, please pick it up and read it. I've taken a lot of your time. I would like to prevail on you, though, to ask you our traditional last question on New Books Network. What are you working on now?
So I'm not really working on religion anymore, although that still is in the back of my mind. But I am still working on this connection between political economy and culture. Particularly, I'm always interested in the question of alternative modernities. You know, what other alternative forms of modernity in terms of ideas and practice? And I'm exploring that question through the lens of right now looking at alternative forms of conceptualizing and practicing democracy in contemporary Korea, or since the 1990s, a little before the IMF reforms, but particularly looking at the alternative conceptions of democracy, practices of it under neoliberalism, and seeing how ideas of democracy and practices of democracy have changed in relation to the economy in three areas. Architecture, so how does the shape of buildings and the forms of buildings and space basically reconceptual ideas of democracy under neoliberalism. I'm also looking at design, product design, and so forth. So how do objects reshape agency and in relation to democracy under neoliberalism? And then finally, looking at food, and particularly under food, agricultural cooperatives. So this is the connection between my last book, looking at Hansalim, Dure, iCoop Korea, and their ways of trying to create these alternative modernities, reconceptualizing spatial conceptions between relationships between the urban and rural to create these alternative modernities and these alternative democracies under neoliberalism. So it's a little, and I've moved out of the colonial period, and I've kind of moved away a little bit religion, but I will say this, Hansalim is very influenced by Tongak philosophy. And so it's become very useful, my knowledge about Tongak and trying to understand Hansalim.
Right. Oh, excellent. Well, that sounds like a really interesting project. And maybe we can work it out. One of our other hosts can do your next book. Since it won't be on religion, I don't know how much I can comment it, but maybe we have a channel on new alternative modernity.
Yeah.
We should have one, certainly.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. Yeah.
Well, good deal. Thank you so much, Albert, for your time today.
Well, thank you, Frank. Thanks so much, as always, for giving me this opportunity to talk about my work and really to just have this conversation with you. I always enjoy it. I really do appreciate the opportunity you give me.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners for listening to us today. Thank you again, Albert. You have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
This has been New Books in Christian Studies. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll come back and listen again soon. Thank you.